Author, poet, and activist Grace Paley died this week of breast cancer. She was 84. When she was named New York's first official state writer in 1986, she said the only thing nicer might be if she got an award from her block. That's because she became famous and acclaimed for writing about the neighborhood and the everyday life of her neighbors. In the Bronx, where she was born and raised. In the Village, where she raised her family. And in Vermont, where she lived out her life with her husband, playwright Robert Nichols. Though her career as a writer spanned half a century, Paley published only three collections of short stories. The Little Disturbances of Man in 1959, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute in 1974, and Later the Same Day in 1985. In addition to her writing, Paley was known for her work as a women's rights and peace activist. The FBI kept a file on her in the 60s. Terry spoke with Grace Paley in 1985. Here's Paley reading an excerpt of a story from her collection Later the Same Day.
First, I wrote this poem. Walking up the slate path of the college park under the nearly full moon, the brown oak leaves are red as maples, and I have been looking at the young people. They speak and embrace one another. Because of them, I thought I would descend into remembering love. So I let myself down hand over hand until my feet touched the earth of the gardens of Vesey Street. I told my husband, I've just written a poem about love. What a good idea, he said. Then he told me about Sally Johnson on Lake Winnipesaukee, who was 12 and a half when he was 14. Then he told me about Rosemary Johansson on Lake Sunapee. Then he told me about Jane Marston in Concord High. Then he told me about Mary Smythe of Radcliffe when he was a poet at Harvard. Then he told me about two famous poets, one fair and one dark, both now dead, when he was a secret poet working at an acceptable trade in an office without windows. When at last he came to my time, that is, the past 15 years or so, he told me about Dottie Wasserman. Hold on, I said. What do you mean, Dottie Wasserman? She's a character in a book. She's not even a person. Okay, he said. Then why Vesey Street? What's that? Well, it's nothing special. I used to be in love with a guy who was a shrub buyer. Vesey Street was the downtown garden center of the city when the city still had wonderful centers of commerce. I used to walk the kids there when they were little carriage babies, half asleep. Maybe take the ferry to Hoboken. Years later, I'd bike down there on Sundays, ride around and around. I even saw him three times. No kidding, said my husband. How come I don't know the guy? Ugh. The stupidity of the beloved. It's you, I said. Anyway, what's this baloney about you and Dottie Wasserman?
The voices that you write with for the narrator and for the characters, I think are really like vernacular voices, and they're always so perfect. Everybody doesn't speak the same. Everybody has their own really distinctive way of speaking. It's very, for some of them, it's very ethnic. For others, it's very urban. You grew up in the Bronx in the 1920s. Can you describe what your neighborhood was like?
Well, every week somebody's furniture was on the street. I mean, that's my first memories of my block, is that all of this, people were evicted, well, every day. And you'd see this pile of furniture out there covered with newspapers and covered with tarpaulin. And that, it was mostly it was practically entirely Jewish. And people there came from Eastern Europe, Poland and Russia, mostly. And in our house, the languages that were spoken were Russian, Yiddish, and English.
Did you speak
all of those?
And
they were spoken in equal parts. Well, I never spoke either Yiddish or Russian well, but I always understood it very well and spoke it to my grandmother because she never got English.
Were there real talkers in your family or in the neighborhood who you would listen to and whose speech you think really affects you now in your writing?
Well, my father was a great talker. My mother was very quiet, and I think probably because my father was such a great talker. But he really was a good storyteller and very smart and very funny. And my mother was very serious and quite different, but very straightforward and very honorable person. And in the neighborhood, the people talked all the time. And people sat outside in the street, you know. The street life was very exciting. And you couldn't get me some summer nights. Since I was the youngest by a lot, I was also overprotected and also neglected at the same time. Like, I'd have to wear long stockings, you know, into the end of April. But on the other hand, they'd kind of forget that I was still outside at 11 o'clock at night on a summer night. So I had that kind of happy mixture. But the street was full of people, and it was a great, I think all writers are people who get in the habit, who love to listen, who listen a lot. So that one of the stories in this book is called The Story Hearer. And it's really what every storyteller has to be.
Were there stories that would get told to you over and over again, or was it not that kind of storytelling? Was it just like more like gossip in the street that people would talk about?
Well, first of all, I have a lot of regard for gossip. I regard it as the last great oral tradition, and the reason it's called gossip is that women do it, so that therefore it's kind of denigrated for that reason. But those were stories to me, you know, that people told about their life. What happened to you yesterday? You know, that kind of story. What happened? Oh, you know, so he came home then, did he? Yeah, you know, and all of that kind of thing. And then the stories of my family at home were always telling what had happened, and first in Europe and then here, and there was a lot to hear and a lot to listen to. And you listen because you think, oh, this is going to be my life. This is my life. I'm hearing my future. I'm hearing what I'm about.
When you started writing, did you go through a period of wanting to get the neighborhood out of your voice?
Oh, no. See, when I wrote stories, I was what I was, you know. And I never felt like wanting to get to change my language. In my own speech, I remember when we were going to school, and there was something that I used to call Hunter College English, and I swore to God I'd never talk like that, no matter what happened. You know, it seemed like a theft of my language, of my New Yorkese, and it bothered me. And there was a lot of the older people, a little bit older than I, were. In my sister and brothers, among my sister and brothers' friends, really had begun to talk like that. And also, I don't think people realize this, but during the Depression or after the Depression, the only jobs people began to go into were teaching. Women could go into teaching. Well, the exams they gave in New York for teachers, and that included my sister and many of her friends and my sister-in-law, the exams they gave were very strict orals. So those orals were really designed at that time, although it seems now that three-quarters of the teachers in the city of New York say are Jewish, it seems like that, whether it's true or not. At that time, those exams were designed to keep immigrants out. And so people were going around like crazy trying to talk American, you know, and taking classes in it. And that was what used to drive me mad. I mean, I would just say, oh, you're all talking Hunter College English.
You didn't start writing short stories until you were in your 30s. Why weren't you writing short stories before? It just seems such the natural form for you.
Well, I thought my natural form was poetry. It's easy to say that now. But I thought of myself as a poet, I never thought of myself as a poet. I always thought of myself as a poem writer, but in my 30s, the poems couldn't serve me. I mean, for what I wanted to do and for what I was thinking about, and of course, what I was really thinking about and what was pressuring me in my life, which is where things come from. Really is something about women and men and how we lived, how we were not living together well on this earth, and how, and also, by then I'd had a couple kids and I'd gotten much closer to women and thought a lot about women's lives and was very interested in them, and that's what I wanted to understand. I mean, you come to writing, not from what you know, but from what you come to it with what you don't know. And that's what presses you to go on.
How much did you want your political views and your political activism to enter into your stories?
Well, I can't say I ever felt I pushed them in. I mean, I think when I began to write about women in the beginning, those were really, that was not so much a political view as it was a political concern. That is to say, when you write, you really, what you do is you illuminate what's hidden, and that's a political act. So if I did, and I hope I did, illuminate the lives of women, of the women I knew who were alone with kids and all that, that was a political act. So I illuminated them. They didn't happen to, whatever their political positions were, that was another story. But that was, from the beginning, I consider political, so to speak. Now, as for all the other interests of the women, insofar as that it's that it, in the way that it's a natural part of their lives, I certainly want it in there. I am interested, as I said, in certain events and then directions in the world, trends, and I am fearful for the world, and of course that has to get into it. You can't. It's not a question of want. It's there. You don't want, or you do want everything. There isn't anyone who writes a novel or a story that isn't political one way or another.
Grace Paley, speaking with Terry Gross in 1985. The author, poet, and activist died this week at the age of 84. This is Fresh Air.